Good morning, everyone from London. Thank you so much for joining us for this Innovation Forum webinar. My name is Toby Webb, and I'm going to be moderating for the next 45 minutes or so. We may run on 5 minutes or so past the 45, because Laura Okkonen, who's due to join us from Vodafone, is slightly delayed. But in the meantime, well, that's more than made up for by the fact that we have Chris Ettery, Director of Supply Chain Sustainability for Dell, joining us, and Bennett Northcutt, who's Director of Corporate Responsibility for the John Lewis Partnership. And of course, we're all supposed to be physically together this week at our conference, but given the coronavirus challenges, we're going digital and online. So thank you for your support and joining us as part of our online day today and tomorrow to discuss the important issues around our ethical trade and human rights webinar series. There is another webinar later on today, as I'm sure you know, and more tomorrow. And I hope that you can join us for those. In this session, we're going to be talking about supply chain risk mapping, advances in technology to map and monitor supply chain risks. So plenty to talk about there. And what I thought I would do is just ask our speakers to say what they do is their sort of day-to-day job that's relevant to this, issues that they're working on in their companies. And then we'll discuss how technology is an enabler, but not perhaps a silver bullet, but certainly a powerful tool. And then we'll talk about how we overcome challenges and so on. And we do have time for questions. So there is a questions box on the webinar software. But just to let you all know, it is a very small box. And if you write a long essay, I will probably not have time to read it because it will be in a tiny font. So if you can keep your question short and punchy, you have much more chance of getting it asked by me to our panelists. So I hope that's clear in terms of an order of play. So let me start by asking Chris Ettery from Dell. Chris, welcome. Thank you for making the time. Why don't you just tell us as briefly as you can what it is that you do for a living and how it's relevant to this topic, and then we'll move on to hearing from Bennett. So Chris, welcome, and over to you to start us off.
Thank you very much, Toby, and hello, everyone. I hope everyone's doing well during these challenging times. So as Toby mentioned, I work for Dell. I'm a director in our supply chain sustainability team, which, interestingly enough, we do actually form part of the supply chain. So we have a team embedded in the supply chain, which is dedicated to running the assurance programs that we have in place on the manufacture of our products. And as you probably know, Dell, as well as making notebooks and desktop computers and monitors, we also do cloud computing, storage, and things like that. So my role is to drive assurance on the way those products are being manufactured. And I co-lead the team in that, as well as myself, based in EMEA, but also overseeing LATAM and North America, I have a colleague who also runs a team focused in APJ, which is dedicated to assurance programs and supplier engagement for some of our suppliers based there. So overall, Dell has a wide global supply chain. So typically, you know, if we think about it, it's four different layers. At the final assembly layer, we have in-house and outsourced manufacturing. In a direct space, we have about 150 direct suppliers, and then below that we have sub-tiers who supply the parts that go into the components to make our products. And then ultimately we also then run all the way upstream to the point of mineral sourcing and how some of the minerals that are used in our products, how they are won and supplied into our supply chain. So that's as an overview. I'm very looking forward to talking about the types of tech that we're using to help monitor and work on some of the supply chain challenges we face as across the globe.
Chris, thank you. That's very helpful. Bennett, tell us what you do day to day.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Okay, what Chris says, I hope everybody is okay. Really quite extraordinary times that we're living in just now, the implications of which I don't think we've begun to even comprehend. Anyway, yes, so my role is I'm the sort of group director for CR across for the John Lewis Partnership, which includes the John Lewis department store and the Waitrose, our Waitrose supermarkets. Across both brands, we sell about 380,000 separate products. As joking aside, you know, John and Sparkship basically sort of sells everything, and so we sort of have a footprint in pretty much every complexity with supply chains that you might have. And obviously, we at one level we will be selling Chris's products, many of his products in our John Lewis shops, through to sourcing lamb from a small family farm in Cumbria. And so the sort of breadth of what we are sourcing and the complexity which we're facing into is quite large. My role, I sit in the strategy team within the partnership, my role specifically is around operating to do two things. First of all, to ensure that we have the right standards and policies and procedures in place for all our suppliers around the world, and that we are then providing the necessary assurance back to the board to ensure that, you know, procedures and policies are being followed. We then have teams in both sort of food and general merchandise who then stay close to the commercial teams who ultimately are responsible for ensuring that the standards are maintained and that the contracts that we sign are delivering products that we what we expect. So we sort of build in the criteria we need around whether that's material sourcing or indeed the standards required of the manufacturers. We build those into the commercial contracts that we have with our suppliers.
Great, Bennett, thank you very much. Laura, I understand you've joined us. Are you with us?
Yes, hi Toby, this is Laura.
Hi Laura, so thank you so much for joining us. I know you may have missed the first couple of minutes, but I was just asking Chris and Bennett just to describe what their day jobs are, really, to give us a bit of context before we move in. So perhaps you can do that as well and tell us what you're up to at Vodafone. I think last time I saw you, you were working for Nokia. So
yes, how has things
changed, and what are you up to for Vodafone? What's your main role?
Thanks, Toby. I work at Vodafone Group as the senior human rights manager. And that basically means that I lead the human rights work, including governance, accountability, and policy at Vodafone. For those of you who are not all that familiar with Vodafone, we are a mobile communication service provider. We operate in 25 markets across Europe and Africa. We have approximately 530 million mobile customers in these markets, and at around 108,000 direct employees worldwide. In addition to the direct employees, we have a wide range of suppliers and other commercial third-party relationships. And we really do, as a multinational company, rely on international supply chains. We have approximately 11,000 suppliers. And as Toby referred to, prior to joining Vodafone, I was the head of human rights at Nokia. And this is very much part of that same supply chain. So it's the information communications technology supply chain. And we do obviously work together very closely with our suppliers, but also others in the industry, which I hope to elaborate a little bit further later in the call or in the discussion. And again, as said, it's very much about internally driving compliance, making sure that the governance on understanding what the risks are and mitigating those risks are in place and work. And it's very much a team effort. So we work very closely with our procurement department, which is a centralized department. And in some ways, it probably makes it a little bit easier because it is a centralized function in group. So it's easier to have that transparency across all procurement operations. I myself, I'm based in Group External Affairs in the Sustainable Business Team in Paddington. Well, working from home now as everyone else, but our offices are in Paddington.
Great, Laura, thanks very much. So Chris, let me come back to you and move on to the point about the key issues you're working on. I mean, obviously the obvious ones around human rights are there for every company in terms of compliance with cutting edge human rights policies. And I have no doubt that Dell, Vodafone, John Lewis are all signed up to every initiative going in terms of human rights standards and make those clear to their suppliers, which is when you do your materiality kind of assessments, Chris, tell us really how those are evolving so that you can keep on top of these difficult moving target challenges you have around supply chain risk mapping. Just give us a brief overview, if you wouldn't mind, on how that approach is evolving and the biggest issues you're facing.
So thanks, Toby. I mean, I think the approach we've kind of taken in Dell is one that we've been fortunate to be able to partner quite a lot with other companies in the tech sector. So, you know, we've kind of come together to develop a single set of sector-wide standards, which allow us to ensure that when we're talking to our suppliers, and many of our suppliers would support more than just one tech firm, we're able to talk to them in terms of asking them to all push towards the same sorts of standards rather than us each individually expecting different things. And I think, you know, in those positions, then it becomes very difficult to kind of leverage a common theme or a sustained improvement. So we've sort of taken that approach in terms of coordinating across that. And I think if you look at the pattern since 2006, when that was first put in place, you know, we're continuing to see some of the challenges sort of moving away from, I think, kind of systemic large scale challenges, much more into kind of localized specific issues, depending on where the company or the supplier is based. And, you know, seeing, you know, based on that, those local circumstances, how we can activate on things. I mean, I think specifically, you know, we're in places now where, as our standards have progressed over the last 10 years, some of the legal frameworks we worked to don't actually change that much. And so you're in a position where you're working with suppliers in different countries, say Taiwan or Singapore, where the use of, say, recruitment fees for people to pay labor agents is legal, whereas, you know, in our standards, it isn't something that we would accept. So you're in a situation there where you're working with suppliers to ask them to meet your standards rather than meet what's legally required. And so, you know, we've seen over time, you know, there are more instances of that situation. And that's where, you know, as I'm talking about working partnership with other companies in the tech sector, this is also where we have to work in really close partnership with our suppliers, because ultimately, you know, as much as, you know, we are able, and we can talk a little bit more about some of the mechanisms that we have in place to map where we think there are challenges and what we need to remediate them, you know, ultimately we need their partnership to be able to willing to kind of progress so that we're actually kind of able to move at the speed we need to.
Thank you. Let's come back to talk about some of the collaborations and partnerships, because obviously they are key to bringing in efficiency, managing risk, and to having scale and leverage in certain markets. But Laura, let me turn back to you then. Same question as I had for Chris, really. I mean, I don't think there's a need to describe all the different human rights standards you've signed up to in detail, in the sense that, you know, any large company is signed up to them. But just really trying to get a sense of how your approach to mapping risk is evolving in these fast-moving and uncertain times.
Right. Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? Vodafone is, I mean, we're a little bit of a different kind of animal, because we are a communication service provider, which means that we're not a mass market manufacturer, and we do not really directly own or operate large factories or other production facilities. We do have a small plant that manufactures specialist automotive IoT components in Italy, but apart from that, we don't operate or own or control the manufacturing plants that make the devices that are sold in our stores, or the network equipment that we deploy in our network. Somebody mentioned the human rights impact assessment, and that's obviously something that we continue to do on a daily basis. We did a couple of years ago a big in-depth impact assessment to really properly understand and document our risks on modern slavery in our supply chain. And as a result of that assessment, we know that our greatest areas of potential exposure are linked to things like procurement of manufactured electronic products and the construction services for our mobile and fixed assets. So guys basically building the towers, for example. And we also identified limited risks on things like warehousing of our products and customer support and telesales activities carried out in high risk geographies. Some of these we operate ourselves and some of them are outsourced. On partnerships, we are a member of the Joint Audit Cooperation Initiative, and that is an association of 17 telecommunication operators established to improve really the ethical, labor and environmental standards in the ICT supply chain. And that has been a really, really big factor for all of us, because not only do we join forces in auditing, supplier auditing, but we also work together with the suppliers in the supply chain, and we also share audit reports from these suppliers' audits with all the members.
Okay, thank you, Laura. We will come back in a minute and ask you both about how your use of technology is evolving. Bennett, retail and human rights risk management, really tough area. I have a lot of empathy and sympathy, whichever is the right term, with retailers, because where do you start with your tens of thousands of SKUs? Obviously, you're selling Chris's product, so you don't worry too much about Dell, given that they're handling it themselves. But just kind of evolving to try and do what you can on the risk side here.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and absolutely right. So for a Dell product, we don't worry. And equally, you know, whilst we're very proud of our relationship with companies like Dell, or you know, dare I say, Apple or others that we work with, the truth of the matter is that if I was to ring up Dell and say, "Here are our standards," Dell would just go, "Who are you?" and hang up and move quickly on with their own approach, because we're not a particularly big customer of Dell. What's surprising about a retail supply chain is, whilst we might be a very, you know, our position in the market, what was sort of 5% of UK grocery, or you know, depending on your particular aspect on home, whether it can be the biggest in some areas or sort of definitely in the top three in others, in John Lewis, actually the companies we're buying from will still be buying a relatively small number of their products, or buying a small proportion of the output of their factory. So our relative influence is quite low in a lot of cases, which does alter the relationship that you have. That's not an excuse for inaction. By the way, you know, can people say, "Oh, there's nothing we can do, listen to us," because of course we do have some influence in these things, but it does alter the relationship. So a lot about the relationship that might exist with Dell then also does then exist in terms of how we deal with other suppliers. I mean, one of our commercial directors just got back from China, a few weeks ago now. I was talking to him and he was saying how, you know, the factory had put a lot of time and effort into a lot of demands for higher standards from us and other of their customers, only to then see all their work move to Africa. And the factory suddenly operating at sort of 70% capacity because it just lost a huge contract because an American customer just moved all the production to Africa, where the standards were lower. So there is still a battle about how you know, you maintain getting the product at the price you need, but within the while still driving the highest standards. The approach we've taken around this is, you know, we have our basic compliance program, which exists, which we call Nano, No Audit, No Order, and we, you know, do all the sort of usual things about that. But as we all know, auditing and things will only get you so far, and certainly when you get into the sort of muck and bullets of manufacturing saucepans or colanders, or making beds, or sewing rugs, or picking tomatoes in Italy, auditing is only ever going to get you about 5% of the way there. So the approach we've taken or are taking is to try and build more collaborative relationships, where essentially we're trying to share learning about how you manage a factory or a farm well, to help the local management understand that if you run something well, then that probably includes happy people as a result. And if you have happy people, then that will result in positive outcomes. And so it's that sense of actually, can we, if we shorthand this for us as a partnership, we're co-owned and we believe that, you know, if you work in a business, it's a really good idea for the people who work in the business to have a voice in how that business is run. And so we sort of are trying to take that philosophy and apply it to our supply chain. You know, so if you are making saucepans for John Lewis, then you should be able to, you know, actually the principle of talking to your workforce and having your workforce having a voice, worker voice in the jargon, is tremendously important. And so we run really two programs, one which is we call our Better Jobs program, which is actually using the language we use internally, which is really, if you strip it back, about skilling up the management in our supplier factories through series of questionnaires and using staff surveys to skill them up in terms of actually just talking to their people. And then secondly, within the food supply chain, we run a program through the Waitrose Foundation, which is really about creating true shared value on the product between us as the retailer, between the wholesaler, who is the packer, who's basically providing us with our finished product, and then the farmers on site. And we do that through a sort of price transparency. So a premium gets paid through the pricing, through the supply chain, which then actually gets straight down to the farmer. It operates slightly differently to the fair trade model. And in fact, we think creates a much closer relationship between the farmer and us. So it's really about exactly, there's only so much that we can do to actually manage the risk, because, you know, actually our control line influence is relatively small and the scope is so broad. And in fact, trying to have a different approach, which is let's try and show how you can build partnerships with suppliers where they actually benefit from that partnership in terms of how well they run their businesses and therefore able to be better businesses. And therefore that, we hope the end point of that will be a more positive outcome for people who actually work in those environments.
Thanks, Bernard. And of course, I think we'd all agree it's much easier to go into a factory that's not perhaps as familiar with the language of human rights and ethical trade as we all are and talk about better management rather than better human rights. And of course, one should lead to a good outcome with the other. So I think that's a very helpful paradigm and approach. Tell us, Bennett, while you're on, I suppose, then I'll move to Laura and Chris. How is technology then playing a role? You talked about upskilling. You talked about engaging factory managers in being better at what they do, which I'm sure they'd all be willing and keen to do. What does technology do for you, and how is that use of it improving and increasing?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Actually, just before I answer that, actually, it is interesting. A lot of factories, you know, you go to and you say, now we'd like you to take part in this survey and attend this webinar we're running for people. And you get a kind of, no, I'm too busy. And by the way, you're not a big enough customer for me to waste time on your little scheme. So you have to do a little bit of persuasion with the factory owners to get them to join in sometimes in these schemes. Usually a phone call from the buyer helps unlock that sort of thing. In terms of technology, I mean, at one level, I think it is actually quite basic. I mean, I'll park on the side, as you've already done, the sort of, of course, we use all the risk mapping tools and that sort of stuff and material mapping tools to sort of try and inform people about what's going on and to sort of know what the risk profiles are on products and country. So we have some sort of sense of how to manage that. But I think actually it's really quite a simple level. Firstly, actually just using, we're trying to use a lot of survey tools through this Better Jobs program and asking companies to actually, you know, sign up and then ask their people to go through and just use a simple online survey tool to begin to open up that dialogue between the workforce and the management. And then secondly, beginning, and this has just been delayed in the last couple of weeks for obvious reasons, but with our Chinese supply base, you know, we've been looking at how we begin to use WeChat as a tool to bring factory owners together. So as they come into the Better Jobs program, we then create a WeChat group for them all, and then out of our Hong Kong sourcing office, be able to use that tool to sort of keep open and free dialogue going between everybody. When we actually get this back up and running in China is anyone's guess right now. But that's the sort of vision for it. I think at the end of the day, I don't see a sort of black box solution, blockchain solution or whatever it is that just pops out of the box that solves the human rights problem. Of course, there will be greater transparency. And I think the sort of the sense that more and more stuff being published, whether that's, you know, we publish our factory lists and that sort of thing, that sort of transparency might well drive some other tools that want to query that kind of data in time. But we probably won't lead on that. We'll probably just feed data in as it's required.
Thank you. And on the blockchain question, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, one can't go on LinkedIn without seeing 10,000 people who are global keynoting blockchain experts. So it kind of looks like technology's everywhere. But from a sort of amateur perspective of mine, it sort of looks to me like it's perhaps quite useful for products, but a lot more problematic for people. Is that an unfair characterization?
No, I'd agree with that very strongly. I think the application, I mean, in some ways, blockchain at its simplest is just a database, right? And that's all it is, if you want to be, you know, really robust about it. The point is, it's there, it's immutable, it can't be edited or changed. That's the sort of key advantage from it in that way. And that, I think, opens up applications around product, around, you know, okay, verification of what is in that product, whether that's, you know, here, how does certification for timber, for example, come through? And actually, we're beginning to think about applications for it around circular products. So nothing to do with human rights, but, you know, if we're manufacturing a circular table, spot my joke, our circular economy table, then that, you know, how do you guarantee that in 20 or 30 years time, when a John Lewis table might be looking a little tired, that you actually know precisely which products are in it and what things are made of and how you might recycle it? And could you, in fact, use the blockchain to capture some of that data? So that we can guarantee that the, you know, the IT will still be available in a sort of, you know, decades hence. Bearing in mind that, you know, I can't currently, you know, get my virtually play my CDs anymore because as I've just unplugged my CD player. So technology moving on so fast, but the blockchain offers an opportunity for people in the future perhaps to be able to still access data.
Thank you. Yes, let's hope so. So, Laura, let me turn to you. Technology, I mean, you're very much a technology company. Are there any surprising revelations you have for us about how technology is enabling better human rights performance? Or is it merely rolling out of existing tools is still a bigger challenge, and that's where the leverage and the gains can be had? Laura, over to you.
Thank you. That's a very good question. Even as a representative of the tech sector, I would not be comfortable in hailing technology as the solution to tackle and minimize all human rights risks from supply chain. I think it will always require human involvement, and technology can support the human involvement to help increase things like transparency, for example. One thing that we have done with our supply chain is that we have actually started using mobile devices to gain insights into the views and experiences of some of our tier two suppliers' employees. So whenever we do a supplier audit, we actually also ask the employees to use their personal mobile phones to provide anonymous feedback on key aspects on their working conditions. And these surveys are always done in a local language. And we have actually found these surveys really helpful because they can be done, the employees can do these in their own time, so they don't need to be done under the watchful eye of the management. And we've shared our experiences through the Joint Audit Committee and quite a few of the other members in the JAC, as we call it, have actually also started adopting this survey. So. That's one thing where we have found that technology can really support us in digging deeper in our supply chain. Another thing that we've done is that we've also created a free online training, which is actually available, publicly available. So it's not only for our suppliers, it's it's available for everyone. It's an interactive modern slavery online training, which really focuses on the challenges of the ICT supply chain. We've tried to make it a modern kind of training, so it has an avatar, and we follow the avatar through the different modern slavery risks that exist in the work cycle. We continue to actively promote it to our suppliers, and quite a few of our suppliers have actually, they've held the training to their employees. So this isn't something that we necessarily ask the employees to look at, but we promote it to the suppliers to provide this training to their employee, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you. So it sounds like it's very much existing technologies that are being put to use here. Any comment on the blockchain point? It's just, it's, you know, it's a very topical technology.
Yeah.
And I wondered what your conversations are around its potential use in your chain.
Well, we've had quite a bit of discussions on blockchain, and especially in the context of raw minerals. And I think one thing that we potentially tend to overlook in this discussion on blockchain, from at least from the European perspective, that increasingly when you go outside Europe, many of these local suppliers still operate on paper trail. So that's where the blockchain starts. You first need to ensure that these suppliers, I mean, digitization connectivity is there to enable blockchain to work. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Chris, you've been listening patiently to all of this. Do you have any revolutionary technology solutions you're incorporating, or is it similar as with Bennett and Laura, utilizing what you currently have more efficiently?
Well, it's already Bennett and Laura have already covered some really great use cases. So what I might try and do is just add on to a couple of things, if that's okay, and then also talk about our experiences of blockchain. So I think the digital learning piece is a really key one. Similar to Bennett and Laura, you know, we have online platforms, we have them available in lots of different languages. I think we've done a pretty good job in terms of integrating those platforms into our sort of regular discussions we have with suppliers and our regular assurance program. So, you know, one insight I'd like to share is, you know, especially where you're finding regular issues with suppliers, you know, making sure then that you're directing them to the content that's on the platform as part of the remediation and being able to track that they've completed it. So that, you know, it becomes, you know, less of a kind of self-service and more of an expectation that's driven from the customer. I would also talk about training, to sort of think about training, you know, along the lines of what Laura and Bennett mentioned, which is as a way of cascading information and getting some kind of signal from the supply chain, especially. Bennett gave a very good example of, you know, how as a buyer, their influence may diminish according to different types of suppliers, and that's true of other companies. As you go further upstream, you know, the level of influence you might have can differentiate. Where, you know, if you've got someone who's supplying capacitors to all range of tech companies, the fact that Dell's contacted them doesn't actually mean a lot. But the fact that we have a strong digital platform which people in their factories can access in their local language and are able to use to kind of pick up on very specific aspects of their operation, be that health and safety, or what we found recently has worked very well is launching training on COVID-19 and being able to track the use of those training modules and the use of different mechanisms like open hours. It gives some more signal than we would have otherwise. Specific to risk mapping, I would also flag, and Bennett mentioned this, there are a lot of existing tools out there that use supply chain mapping and things like that. We've found it useful to build additional tools on top of those. Typically, a lot of the supply chain mapping tools, you tend to get the news when something's already gone wrong. And of course, when we're talking about risks, We all want to get to the point where the risk is identified and mitigated before something goes wrong. And so, you know, one thing that's in maybe interest of people participating in this webinar is, if you're not making use of it and you are operating in China, the IPE, the Institute of Public and Environmental Affairs in China, they produce a very good tool called the Blue Map that provides information about regulatory affairs in China. And we've used that as a basis to develop a kind of an additional functionality which pulls information from them, but also pulls information from other publicly available sites so that we're able to get the warning signals a bit earlier in the process and try and do something to mitigate that, be that, you know, on a water side, not just thinking about specific water discharge from our suppliers, but then thinking about, well, how, what's actually happening in the overall watershed. And of course, especially when we're talking about water, we want to be thinking about the whole basin level rather than individual suppliers to kind of ensure that we're taking the right actions. I would also, you know, one area we found very helpful to promote is, you know, audits, you know, are a good way of driving very specific actions, although by their very nature, you can be limited in scope. So, I mean, we run about 400 audits a year with different suppliers. And what we've managed to use through the technology side is running those audits and all the corrective actions after it on a single platform that's accessible both to us and the suppliers. And we found that very useful in terms of documenting what's being happened and what actions are being done, but also kind of developing a single source of truth between us and the supplier. And so especially where we're having regular business reviews of these suppliers, involving senior managers from both companies, to be able to have a single source of truth that you can go to and a way to drive further progress if things are slipping behind timescales. We found that kind of invaluable. And of course, as you develop it over time, it means that even though the likes of me may be going elsewhere, then whoever follows in my footsteps will also have the documented information to find. On the blockchain side, and we've looked at it in a different ways. There's quite a number of large scale pilots that are happening in blockchain. We decided in the end to try and build a small version ourselves. So taking a raw material that we use for some packaging and to see how blockchain can work for that. And I do think, you know, there is definitely insight that can be driven from blockchain. You know, it is a bit of a digital ledger, but where you're working in less formal supply chains, it is a way of imposing some kind of framework, some kind of structure, especially where a company like Dow would have less influence on the supplier behavior, to begin to see how things work and why and building up a bit more of a record on it. You know, we found it's been quite useful. At the same time, it is incredibly difficult. So, I mean, if there are people out there who can say they're experts in blockchain, that's great. We found, you know, we're working with a few different partners and it is, you know, it's incredibly, it's quite slow progress. And I think Laura hit on the good point, which is how do you make the technology associated with the blockchain sufficiently accessible that people, and it's our example, we're building it in APJ. We're spending a lot of time being able to build the modules so that the apps are easily updated at areas where the technology and connectivity may be lower.
Great, thanks very much. Well, we've got about 5 or 10 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about, all of you, about what the potential is for what I might call external technologies. I guess social media. I mean, Bennett, you've mentioned WeChat. Chris, you mentioned a resource in China that contains useful information. But with the explosion of social media, you know, we're of the sort of Twitter generation, I imagine, the four of us. But, you know, there's TikTok and there's a new social media application without a business model, but with billions in funding being launched every other month, it seems. What is the potential, or what are the conversations that you have internally, or the practices or suppliers that you might use to try and make sense of the constant noise out there and untruths and real facts out there on social media platforms to try and help you manage supply chain risk? I mean, it's a hell of a challenge, I know, because where do you even begin? Bennett, I wondered if that's something that's come up beyond standard kind of media monitoring practices for you.
I mean, the big problem is, of course, is a reputational one on social media, which is, you know, people's, you know, a comment or a position can get made, it can get pushed out there, and your ability to have a subtle conversation in this area is going to be increasingly difficult. I mean, as we all know, you know, this is a subject that is, you know, let's be completely honest, you know, the factories that a lot of our workers are have jobs in, as certainly, you know, a lot of us in sort of, you know, in professional employment, and not the factories we would aspire our loved ones to work in. But, you know, the only thing worse for a lot of these workers than having a job in some of these factories is not having a job in some of these factories. And the area is very, very difficult. And so I think the biggest challenge that social media represents for us is a reputational one of how do you ensure this topic, as everything becomes increasingly transparent, how does this topic not become, you know, the complexities of it are understood. You know, the flip side of that, however, is that, you know, the great transparency that's coming, it will drive, you know, higher levels of performance. We take the view that we as a business are increasingly going to have to be radically transparent in everything. And, you know, I'd love to get to the stage where you can, you know, scan the barcode and, you know, go to a live stream of the factory and, you know, see the worker and, you know, it's all there. Because that, I think, is the general trend of travel, and social media will, in the long term, accelerate that. It's not there yet. So right now, the challenge is, you know, the story heading off in a particular direction. You know, not being able to row that back and not being able to explain in the social media format the complexity of the solutions that you're working on. So, you know, we're very proud of what we do, but to explain what we do in social media without it looking just like a sort of advert or as part of the conversation is really tough.
Thank you. Yes, very helpful perspective. Laura, what are your kind of conversations you're having about this and the practices you're employing at the moment?
Social media. We could have a whole different session on that alone, couldn't we? We essentially really believe in working together. That doesn't only mean working together with our suppliers and our stakeholders, but also working with those who criticize us on potential issues. So if whenever there is any media attention on a specific topic, we really try to make it a point to approach these people in person and these organizations in person, because we really want to know, understand their concerns better and try to work together to address the issues. Because at the end of the day, while I fully appreciate that civil society has a really important role in whistleblowing, we also feel that civil society, and we need to work together to address some of these issues. So social media is a good indicator of trending issues, but then the actual solutions need to be worked on outside social media, I'd say. It's interesting when we are obviously all in the pursuit of greater transparency, but in my personal opinion, this pursuit of transparency also comes with a whole range of potential privacy issues, which we need to acknowledge and be mindful of. So just to go back to the earlier example that was mentioned on being able just to see all the way through the supply chain of a product all the way to the worker. So my question would be, does the worker really want to be seen? And how do we protect the individual workers' right to privacy while we continue our pursuit on transparency?
Thank you. Thank you, Laura. A very good point. I remember about 10 years ago, a UK supermarket, who I won't name, apparently they had webcams on their website where you could see factories in Bangladesh, I think it was. You could see inside the factory on their website and on social media. But there was apparently a challenge that the workers in the factory hadn't been informed about it. Only the management knew, and the workers were wondering what all these cameras were doing filming them. So just goes to show the cultural change element of use of technology is an important one indeed. Chris, let me give the final word to
So, and I always think these sessions are kind of interesting, where we put in some maybe controversial thoughts. So, I'm willing to kind of put forward a thought in terms of, I mean, a level of transparency is important, and you know, during a session, it's already been noted by Laura and Bennett, you know, publishing lists of suppliers, providing insight into the way that products are being made, providing some level of assurance is of course vital. And depending on the questions that come from different stakeholders, we can build things. But you know, I think sometimes when everyone's driving for transparency, you know, in some cases it's, in my experience, it's come from a little bit of a lack of knowledge. And so thinking that if there's more information out there, everything would kind of become apparent, which I don't know whether that is always the case. I mean, you know, I think all of us on this panel, I mean, we're pretty expert in what we do. We do it because we want to make a better product, make more assured products for our customers and our stakeholders. And so I think the kind of what's the underlying challenge that sometimes is of transparency is that we can spend all our time answering questions and educating everyone on what we're doing in very specific cases, and not spending our time on what we want to do, which is keep working for suppliers, keep getting ready for challenges, and being ready to meet, you know, and we can see it right now in front of us, what a very challenging global situation we're in right now with COVID-19. So, you know, I think this, you know, on, of course, it's important to answer key questions and be open to question. I would not debate that at all, but, you know, this kind of need for saying, well, if I don't understand stuff, you tell me everything and then I'll decide what's important. You know, that's where I think transparency, you know, can have some detrimental consequences as well.
So, very important and helpful points. Let me finish just by asking you all then for one quick question. I know it's very early to say this while we're in the midst of this global crisis, the like of which I think, you know, none of us have ever seen or even envisioned before. But do you see, and Chris, let me ask you this first, and then Laura, and then Bennett, do you see this increased interest in understanding of global supply chains as ultimately going to be helpful in driving more engagement and transparency? Even though I hesitate to use the word silver linings in the midst of this awful crisis, but I suppose what I'm trying to do is finish on an optimistic and longer term perspective from each of you about how we might use the momentum gathered to find the solutions to this particular challenge we have at the moment with coronavirus to drive transparency in the supply chain, drive engagement. Do you see it as something that could be used by folks in your line of work to drive and keep interest in supplier engagement? I know it's a broad question, but I wanted to end on this. It is topical and it does give us something perhaps a bit more optimistic to end on. Chris?
So yeah, I think one optimistic point I would definitely flag. I mean, from my perspective, you know, when we really started seeing this happen, which was really around Lunar New Year. So, you know, especially in APJ, this has been an issue that's been going on for some time. And, you know, I've seen the behavior of our suppliers and the behavior of a lot of stakeholders in APJ, and now kind of moving across the globe. And everyone is putting health and safety, putting ethical considerations at the forefront. You know, I've seen it firsthand in terms of how our suppliers have been trying to support their people during this process, especially in circumstances where, you know, it would be very easy to kind of be catechismatic about it and saying, well, you know, hundreds of people are going to lose jobs and businesses are going to shut down. I mean, from where I'm sitting and all the conversations we're having of our suppliers, I feel like they've really gone the extra mile to try and take care of people who work in their facilities and be responsive to the unique nature, unique set of challenges we face right now. And so, you know, from the point of view of, you know, having a responsible behavior, then that has been writ large for me so far. And so I hope that's something, you know, as this crisis continues to go on, I hope we can see this being maintained throughout. In terms of on the actual kind of supply chain responsibility side, I mean, I think, you know, there's going to be, I mean, there is going to be an interesting, I think, kind of pivot in the way that people understand how the role that businesses can play to try and support workers, I hope. That, you know, we you know, earlier in the discussion that was hosted was talking about how you would see more important state intervention into the economy and what that would happen. I would maybe turn it on its head and say this is a great opportunity for business to step up to the plate and show what we can do. And I think, you know, I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of all three panelists where I feel like these are three examples of companies that are really ready to do that.
Chris, thanks very much. You should be a politician. What a great final speech. Laura, what else is there to say? I mean, I think Chris has done a great job of encapsulating some of the, I hesitate to use the word positives, but certainly increased engagement in these issues. But what would you like to add?
Yes, I agree. Most of the important issues related to this current circumstances have certainly been addressed already, but we are a critical infrastructure provider, so we are very much involved in working in making sure that the networks, first of all, the capacity in our networks supports everyone working from home and working from, I mean, wherever they work. And we work very closely with the authorities to make sure that we facilitate necessary information to citizens on the things that they need to know. And on our suppliers, we obviously welcome the government's various actions to keep businesses afloat, but we also at the same time fully acknowledge the liquidity problems that many businesses, especially micro and small enterprises, may face under these unprecedented circumstances. But we have made a commitment that we will ensure that all the new orders issued to our micro and small suppliers providing goods and services in Vodafone's European operations will be paid in 15 days instead of the standard payment time, which is 30 to 60 days.
Thank you. I know we've run slightly over time, but Bennett, let me give the final comment to you. How do we turn this to our advantage?
Well, I'm just going to start negative and then go positive, I'm afraid. Sorry to be boring. I do think there is a short-term risk to human rights in casual labour supply chains right now, especially within agency workers and modern slavery. I think as governments put emergency stimulus methods in, you know, the checks and things are going to become harder to do. And therefore, if you are trapped in an abusive working relationship right now, your chance of getting out of that right now probably lower than they were a few months ago. So I think we need to be very alive to those risks over the short term. But long term, medium to long term, I think this is a moment where society has a bit of a go left, go right moment, doesn't it? And I'm very much supportive of what Chris said. I think the opportunity is there for us. This is a moment that's as fundamental as World War II in terms of how our society responds. And at the end of World War II, society made the choice to set up the United Nations to agree the international rule of law. Even though the Cold War ran, those institutions remained. And I would hope that as this pandemic comes down, does that present us a new opportunity, having seen countries around the world have this sort of seismic shock and stepping out of the sort of increased of the pace at which globalization has been unwrapping? You know, do we as a world have the choice to agree ways of working that will be both better for people and indeed the planet as well? So I'm cautiously optimistic about that, as long as Joe Biden wins the presidency.
Well, I was wondering whether I should close by saying, you know, only silver lining might be enough voters in the US realizing the fundamental incompetence of the Trump administration. And I thought, well, no, maybe I shouldn't say that. But too late, I have. So thank you, all of you, for your contributions. We really, I think, covered the issues very well. Thanks so much for your time. Listeners, I know we ran slightly over time, but there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot more webinars coming up from Innovation Forum in lieu of our face-to-face conference. So I hope you're enjoying the digital engagement. And with that, I shall bring this to a close so we can move on to our next session shortly. But just remains for me to say one more time, thank you so much to Chris, to Laura, and to Bennett. Thanks so much for all your time.